Hello, for the lore of the land, this is Jack Leffler. Gary Paul Nabhan and his wife Lori Motti have followed many trails together over the years, including to the village of Desemboque, Sonora in Mexico, which is inhabited by Seri Indians. I've traveled with them to Seri country on several occasions to record Seri music and lore. Early on, Gary Nabhan recognized that indigenous peoples have a great deal to teach the rest of us about our personal and collective relationships with homeland. Over 30 years ago, Gary Nabhan founded Native Seed Search, whose mission is to promote agricultural diversity in the arid North American Southwest through crop conservation, seed access, and education. He is the author of numerous books that are really worth reading, and one of my personal favorites is entitled Cultures of Habitat. Gary is a powerful advocate of food shed thinking. Today, on Encounters with Consciousness, we'll listen to Gary Paul Nabhan reflecting on his own culture of practice.
I have retreated from some things that I used to do, in part because of feeling that it's time in my life to turn in a different direction, take on a different trajectory. And part of that has to do with food justice, that the border between Mexico and the United States is the border in the world with the largest disparity in incomes, in diet, buying power, health, and nourishment. And at the same time, the people who live in food deserts today, Native Americans and Mexican American people, who we may call the real indigenous peoples of the Southwest, have been the stewards all along of the richness of foods that can heal the land and can heal their own bodies. But their connection with many of those foods has been broken, or at least wounded. And now many of them are wounded with diabetes and other kinds of nutrition-related diseases. So I'm less worried about writing more books, getting more grants, giving more talks, and doing work in my own community, Patagonia, Arizona, Nogales, the whole sweep of borderlands between the Colorado Delta and Big Bend, and seeing if there's a way that the great biological and cultural diversity of our bioregion can be the very thing that offers green livelihoods to people who've been marginalized by the industrialized agriculture and industrialized military dominance that we see on the border. And what I'd love to see before I die is that the poorest of the poor in our region are not only treated with dignity, but have livable wages for maintaining the plant and animal diversity of our region, for their work rebuilding watersheds that have stopped flowing 50 or 100 years ago through the streams that come down from the mountains as headwaters to become our rivers and eventually make it to the Gulf of California or the Gulf of Mexico. And so my dream is to see before I die a restoration economy where all the wounds that the land has taken and that our indigenous cultures have suffered are healed, and the people who are the descendants of the people who stewarded this great diversity for centuries are again the rightful stewards of that diversity and can make a living off it, that they don't have to move into the cities to find jobs or work in casinos or as short order cooks, when they probably know more about cooking great food than Ronald McDonald and Colonel Sanders ever did. So I'm turning away from thinking that there's secular materialistic solutions to our region's problems and the world's problems. I'm following a Franciscan path, as an ecumenical Franciscan brother, learning as much from Buddhists and Sufi Muslims as I am from contemplative Christians, and seeing how what Douglas Christie calls a contemplative ecology can root me deeper in this land to do the kind of activism that can really last, that we're not responding out of anger, frustration, envy, jealousy, or backlash, as activists have for most of the decades since the first Earth Day, but we're responding with a deep love for the land and for the blessings that our many friends and so many cultures have given us, that we're simply giving back in a way that is not fraught with anger or frustration or cynicism or fatalism, but gives hope and energy to the next generation who'll have to do work as tough or tougher than the work that we've done over our lifetimes in order to buffer their own lives from the dramatic climate change and cultural change that's happening right now. We think that it's bad now with the political regimes that we see around the world and the climatic catastrophes that are happening, but those are marginalizing people who are rising up in anger with a fierceness that's like when you accidentally step on a rake and it hits you in the face with a power that you've never imagined. That's what's happening with the poor in Ferguson, Missouri, and in Libya, and in Syria, and in South America. And we're going to see that unless we realize that we've bankrupted so many people and cultures around this world, that those of us who've been privileged to live without that much pain and poverty now have to assure with those people that there are futures that include them. I think we haven't done our jobs properly. We haven't taken the blessings that have been given to us and pass them on to other generations and to other cultures. And now, more than any time in the history of the earth, we have to act out of love for all that is different than ourselves, our own egos, our own cultures, and assure that that diversity makes it through this incredible bottleneck in history, or else we will be living in post-apocalyptic dystopias.
If we're alive at all.
If we're alive at all.
I'm focusing on some of those same things myself, but also I realize that we have but a finite period of time on the planet.
It's that we're now facing our own mortality, but we're also facing the fact that I think we feel palpably every day that we've lived during such a remarkable time. We've met such talent. We've seen such beauty in the land and in the music of the people around us, that if there's anything we need to distill and instill in the future generations about this beauty, we have to do it now. And we have to have it reach people in ways beyond the mechanisms that we had even a quarter century ago. We need to find ways that the most ancient types of storytelling reverberate out through new media in ways that still capture the power of that storytelling tradition.
I've been trying to do that with recording people like Esteban Arellano, who talks about where the Rio Embudo confluence, so to speak, with Rio Grande, and then when you go further downstream, talking to Rena Swensel, who is so good at expressing the Puebloan point of view, the relationship of culture to habitat and to that riverine habitat along the Rio Grande.
I think in our own minds, those things are already multi-layered, and geographic information systems are now allowing us to offer them to other people in sort of a non-linear, holistic way, where it's the same way many of us have been thinking about these things from the beginning. You know, it's not just that that there's a linear trajectory of history in the Rio Grande, but that some of the incidences that happen earlier come back to haunt us, and we have to break that cycle, dharmic cycle of one generation's mistakes breeding another generation of mistakes, and turn that wheel in a way that we're freed from what oppression and competition and overpowering other people have embedded in this land as scars. We need to go so deep in our thinking about the land that those scars finally heal.
Well, when you think about what happened with Manifest Destiny back in the 19th century and the seeds that that planted, some of which are still sprouting today. I recently spoke with an Apache gentleman, a Chiricahua gentleman, who's the great-grandson of Cochise. His name is Freddy Kedadzini. And he remains shocked at what United States did to the Indian peoples in the 19th century. And in a way, are still doing, trying to get land away from people in order to extract natural resources.
Yeah, we know that there's post-traumatic stress held among Jews 60 years after Auschwitz and the Holocaust. But we forget that there's been other Holocausts, the Holocaust associated with the Spanish Inquisition that forced Jews and Arab Christians and Muslims to flee as far as the Rio Arriba here, that we see the Hopi reliving that post-traumatic stress as Spanish documents about conflicts with the conquistadors are revealed to them in a language that they can understand, and the elders are discussing that. That's what 300 plus years ago that Holocaust happened to the Puebloan peoples here. And so we need to find a way that, as one Jew told his children and grandchildren, we need to find a way to let Hitler die rather than reliving Hitler in every generation in subtle ways. And that's what I feel about this last year, where we've been replaying the unfinished incidents of the civil rights summer, with northern kids on the bus going down to the south. We're seeing black kids and Hispanic kids and Native American kids killed by police on moment's notice for doing nothing, that the replays of those show were moments of life-threatening consequences to the police. And yet, until we come to grips with the fact that we have unfinished business in civil rights and human rights, that just having a president of partial African descent doesn't mean that we're free of the burden of working through our civil rights dilemma so that blacks truly feel that they have equal opportunity as whites, or that Native Americans and Hispanics feel that they have not only equal opportunity but equal capacity to make a living, to own land, to make great pieces of art of great beauty. Until we take care of that unfinished business, we're like a society captured in timeless childhood, like our society is made of teenagers who've never grown up. And so there's something that we need, like an ecosystem needs to mature through its successional stages to be an old growth forest, that has to happen to American culture so that we have the resilience and the strength and the stability to buffer ourselves from storms. But we're sort of stuck in the early successional sears of the weedy communities that germinate, spring up, compete, fight with one another, try to gain dominance, and then die back. We need to get past that and be the sequoias and redwoods and ironwoods of the world, rather than being the trees of heaven coming up through the cracks of Brooklyn.
I've been really watching this piece of land that we live on, it's 12 acres, rewild itself over the last 20 years. And this year has been particularly verdant by virtue of all of the rain. One thing that really becomes ever more clear to me is that we do not own the land. We perhaps buy with money, we buy some sort of a legal right to live on the land, but what a mistake to think that we actually own the land. We're part of it. We can't ever own the land.
It's so funny that land ownership and the ownership of plant genes and the ownership of chemicals is really sort of reaching a dead end, that we're finding people squabbling about whether in owning a piece of land, whether you own the airspace above it, or whether you own the soil below it, or can someone do fracking underneath your land. And so these things that our community has been discussing for 30 years, do trees have standing, are now being played out in the courts in one country suing another country over these things. And I think the answer isn't that courts should decide that individual people or even cultures or nations have exclusive rights over anything. But we think of sovereignty in the broadest possible sense, that you have the capacity to participate in the management and collaboration with the plants and animals and the life of the water and the life of the soil in your place, rather than thinking that it means ownership. It means the privilege of participation. And now we understand that even our own bodies have 10 to the 5th times more cells of other organisms than cells of our own genome, and that we ourselves are wildlife communities, and we can choose to rewild them, or we can choose to knock them back to early successional sears by antibiotics, and that we have to pattern something in the landscape that will last. We need to let it happen, but we also need to do that within our bodies and souls and spirits, that if our answer to every problem is the equivalent of antibiotics, life will find a way to be antibiotic resistant. And that's whether it happens in your ear or in your nose or in a cornfield that has been planted with Monsanto's herbicide-resistant corn, that sooner or later organisms will spring up to take that corn down, that they'll spring up to take those antibiotics down. And I think we have to go back to Kropotkin, and do we participate in ecosystems of collaboration and cooperation, or do we assume that Darwin's message was just about a survival of the fittest mentality, that everyone is competing for their life against others? I think that's a misread of Darwin, not what Darwin was thinking about. And yet it's been used to say that all desert ecosystems, all desert plant communities are nature tooth and claw, competing for scarce water resources. The cutting-edge ecology denies that even for deserts, that that because of scarce resources in a desert environment, there's actually more collaboration. Mycorrhizae on roots, pollinators of Sunita cactus and yuccas and desert fig trees having complete symbiotic relationships between plants and animals, fig wasps and figs or other kinds of insects and cacti that are completely dependent on each other so that their evolutionary destinies are totally fused. And so there's actually more cooperation recognized in desert ecosystems now than competition. And yet we're still behaving as if we're patterning our own human drive to compete on the basis that that's how nature works. And it's a false conception of nature, not only of human nature.
Eleanor Ostrom comes to mind in her old sense of
Nobel Prize winner.
Polycentric governance. In other words, polycentric governance meaning that there are layers of reciprocal governance that extend between the top layer, say from the federal government, all the way down, south end of which would be sort of the grassroots sense of governance, people who actually live within the watersheds, who live within the commons. And there has to be some sort of sense of reciprocal governance like that. Otherwise, a whole huge area of understanding is left out. And I think that it's that grassroots part that's so critical, because they're the people who are intimate with the landscape, intimate with the watershed, people who actually know how everything works and how you have to be there in some sort of successful state. Anyway, Eleanor Ostrom and her husband, Vincent, he's the guy who actually coined the term polycentric governance. Boy, that's such a great thought with regard to thinking about how we govern watersheds.
Right. And that's become a way of life in some Pacific Northwest watersheds. It's now the emerging governing framework for many people in forestation, salmon restoration, all of that. People we know like Lynn House, Freeman House, has really made that a practice in his community, not just abstract concept. What is it now, 150 years after Powell? It's taken the genius of people like Ostrom to show us that that wasn't some wild speculative rant by Powell that was completely preposterous and inoperable, but now many watershed councils are functioning in the tributaries of the Columbia and other watersheds reaching out to the Pacific, because it makes good economic sense, good social cohesion sense, and breaks down the animosity in communities that you and I witnessed during the range wars. The hardest part of what Aldo Leopold's message has been, writing the first paper called Cooperative Conservation, is the day-to-day steadiness it takes to forge long-term collaborations with your neighbors rather than to poke them in the eye and say, you dirty bastards, you're land rapists or whatever, that to bring your community along to the values that you really want to see embedded in the landscape takes enormous patience. It takes the patience of a Zen Roshi or a desert hermit to bring that about. And it's our shortcomings that more of us haven't reached that state of consciousness, that if we really want human consciousness and watershed consciousness to be one and the same, we have to favor collaboration over competition, as St. Francis did when he walked into the Sultan's camp of the Muslim armies during the Crusades and saying, I want to pray in silence with you because we have different words for some of the same things. Will you accept me as a guest rather than as a prisoner? That takes the deepest faith in other human beings to do.
For the last year or two, I've really been thinking a lot about how commons, the whole notion of commons and the whole notion of consciousness kind of comes together in a commons of consciousness, human consciousness.
That's a great concept.
And it really seems to me to be a true thing that over the last, well, couple of 100,000 years since human species came into its own, there's been a vast amount of contribution to the commons of human consciousness. And part of what I'm really interested in is trying to figure out how you can tap in to all of that stuff. And also, it's really important to recognize that we have to be very careful about what we put into consciousness and what we take out of that commons of consciousness. And part of what I think is really critical to making that work is becoming indigenous to homeland. Once you have that sense of indigeneity, then indeed you feel a responsibility for and to the commons, and then you can act appropriately.
What I'm hearing more and more of is that connection to place not only prevents bad things from happening, so that watershed consciousness keeps fracking or dams or diversions from happening in sort of a defensive mode, but watershed consciousness rewires how our brain's synapses flow. We ascend or descend into a different kind of thought process that also protects us from horrors, but also brings great joy to our life. And so what we used to think was merely a difference of ideological constructs that Marxists and capitalists and nihilists had different ideologies, and faith-based people and Gnostics and disbelievers had an ideological gap between the way they looked at the world. We're now realizing that anyone, whether they call themselves Buddhist or Christian or unidentified faith hermit, if they spend enough deep time with the land, their own brain functions are rewired in a way that opens up a receptivity to some of the ideas that you're talking about. That it's not just a difference of content in our brains, but how our brains function with regard to process.
I personally regard Gary Paul Nabhan as one of the most gifted thinkers, a man whose influence will continue to shape our cultural attitudes about skinny dipping in the flow of nature for a long, long time. Encounters with Consciousness is a production of The Lore of the Land. Our series is funded by the Christensen Fund of San Francisco. This is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.